court is ready to hear argument in 050511 in re Southwestern Bell Telephone Company, LP.
May it please the court, Mr. Mike Hatchell will present argument for the respondent. He's reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. This original mandamus action asks a very simple question. Should mandamus issue to require the district court to abate the cause of action while the PUC resolves issues related to the underlying contract between the parties? Because of the prayer in our petition asking for an abatement, the court is not called upon to decide perhaps the more intriguing question in this case, and that is whether or not exclusive jurisdiction in its purest form, what I call super-duper exclusive jurisdiction, applies to the process. We are asking the court to apply what I call either exclusive jurisdiction light or perhaps a heavy version or an excessive version of primary jurisdiction, because what we are asking the court is to apply the doctrine that was held in both Subaru and Nissan, and that is there is at least a piece of this claim, and actually we think the largest piece, that is within the PUC's exclusive jurisdiction, requiring the court to abate, to give the PUC time to decide the issue, and then remand its findings to the court for mandatory adherence to whatever they may be. So if the court accepts the premise that that is the doctrine which is at play, the issue before the court is quite simple. Is there a part of the claims in this dispute which is within the PUC's jurisdiction, even though the claims have labels draped on them like unjust enrichment, fraud, DTPA, and violation of the Texas Antitrust Act?
But it seems to me the main issue is whether the Accutel mega arb rate applies here.
Oh, well, that and may be.
Well,
was your honor?
The parties dispute that, and the argument is that the PUC should be able to determine whether that rate was intended to have a broader effect, or the mega arb was intended to have a broader effect. Were the PUC to determine that the Accutel mega arb rate did not apply, then what would be left that would be exclusively within the PUC's jurisdiction, or if anything?
Once they decide, which I think the mirror image of your question is, that the rates in our contract are proper, then that would be the end of their jurisdiction.
Okay, then that'd be done, and a trial court could determine whether the rates were, the fees were logically or correctly broken up between electronic and manual process.
That's correct, Your Honor, and I think when you look at their claims, you will see that, that really is going to leave very little for the trial court to do. If you just look, for example, at the unjust enrichment claim. Now, their pleadings in this case, I'm just cautioning the court, are vague and I think intentionally so. But they begin with the statement that this is a suit for damages related to overcharges. The charges were only made under the contract. Now, their claim for unjust enrichment says we used our position to, quote, extract charges. Well, that, of course, that claim is unavailable if there is a valid and enforceable written contract that covers the subject matter. So that's clearly at the core of the unjust enrichment claim. Their antitrust claim says that SBC has forced customers to pay more than legally ordered rates. That brings it right back to Your Honor's question. Was the mega arb and the Accutel arbitrations, did they set the rate that had to be in these contracts, even though the PUC approved the contracts with different rates. So that brings the case full circle. Under their DTBA claim, which is very vaguely pleaded, but ends up with stating that the DTPA was violated because there was a misrepresentation about the nature of the contract. But that cannot be actionable if we have correctly interpreted and applied the contract. Their fraud claim says that we induced plaintiffs into signing agreements that called for the CLEX to pay substantially higher amounts than the appropriate rates. Well, again, that brings up the question of what is the appropriate rate that should have been in this contract. We contend, of course, that it's the negotiated rate between the parties that was in the contract. So every claim that they have in this case comes full circle back to the interpretation of the contract and the meaning of the contract insofar as the proper rates are concerned. Your Honor, with that, I'm essentially through. I do say, the court I don't believe has to go this far, that a very strong case could be made that super duper exclusive jurisdiction applies in this case, but we have not prayed for that. And whether or not the court wishes to write on it or not, I think we have briefed that substantially.
Are there any questions? Thank you, Mr. Hatton. The court is now ready to hear from the real party.
May I please report, Mr. Christopher Balish, to present argument for the real party of interest.
May it please the court. My name is Chris Malish, and we're here because my clients are the victims of an SBC swindle in which they're being charged for human labor supposedly necessary to complete service ordering, when in fact SBC employees do not perform any human labor.
But your claims depend upon whether the Mega Arb Accutel rate applies, don't they?
In part. What the Mega Arb did was it set the rate. This is the situation in which the PUC actually examined what went into the price that ought to be paid for these various different things. And in the Mega Arb, the PUC, specifically Chairman Wood on the open record, said that electronic service ordering, like the kind that my clients are doing, should be no more than $258.
Well, again, so the answer to my question would have to be yes, because your whole argument hinges on whether that Mega Arb rate applies to your contracts.
No, it doesn't. Because what happens is the Mega Arb rate is the rate that the PUC says is the appropriate rate.
But
and
that's the question. That they say that it doesn't apply to these contracts. You say it does. If it doesn't apply to this contract, your claims are different, correct?
Well, right. Our claims are not contract claims. Our claims
but
are...
But they depend upon that 258 rate applying.
They depend upon the fact that the PUC has established that as what the correct rate should be.
And if that's an issue in the case, as to whether that's actually what the PUC did, shouldn't it be up to the PUC to make that determination in the first instance?
Well, that's a bit of a circular argument because that is what that was the whole purpose of the Mega Arb. The purpose of the Mega Arb was to look at all the various different input and decide what the rate should be.
But they say it wasn't. I mean, that's the heart of the dispute here. And if that's the heart of the preliminary dispute, why wouldn't the PUC be the first one to take a crack at that?
Well, because the Mega Arb speaks for itself about what it was supposed to do. And if there's a question about what the Mega Arb was supposed to do, it's resolved in the Accutel case. In other words, the PUC has already looked at this. The PUC has already said what it has to say on this subject. It says, this is what the rate for this electronic service ordering function should be. Accutel comes back and says, yes, that is what the rate for this function should be. Now, what we have here is a situation where we have a contract. The contract is one that was, in theory at least, negotiated between the parties. Part of what happened in this negotiation was the fact that SBC says this contract contains rates that were taken from the Mega Arb. And therefore, what's in here is something that the PUC has said should be the rate. Now, as they go through life, our clients transition from processing orders manually. And if you take a look at the visual aid that I've provided, it kind of gives you an explanation of what the different things are that we're arguing about. At the top is what happens when SBC does this for a retail customer. It takes the information from the retail customer. SBC's employee enters the information into a database or a computer program, transmits it into a computer, which actually does all of the service ordering processes. When my clients first started doing business with SBC, they were involved in a situation where they didn't have that technology set up yet. So what they were doing is they would get the information from their end users and they would transmit it either by fax or by telephone call to SBC. So what was happening was that SBC's employees were in fact still doing more or less the same thing they were doing on a retail job, because they were taking the information, they were creating the order, and they were transmitting it. At the bottom we have what happens, what is the subject of this dispute, which is what happens when my clients, not SBC's, employees take all the information, create the order, and transmit it to the computer to be electronically executed without any involvement by SBC employees. And the only thing that SBC actually provides in this instance is an electronic portal, a gateway, kind of like an ATM machine. You know, they're not providing any labor, even though they're charging as though they do. And the fact of the matter is that in this bottom scenario, we actually pay for access to that computer. So we pay a price to be able to do this electronically. So we're paying the price, as it turns out, to process the order electronically. We're paying our people to do the labor, to collect the information and transmit it. And we're having to pay SBC for SBC personnel labor that it claims it's being, that it's providing, but in fact it's not.
All right, let me ask you. I'm unclear still what you're trying to claim here. What does your interconnect agreement provide in terms of a price for electronic processing?
Well, this is a bit of a thorny issue.
Well, it does it or does it not?
This is something that has been in dispute.
Well,
and it has been in litigation and is still currently in litigation at the Fifth Circuit and in the federal
court. So you don't know.
So most recent decision, this went through the PUC on similar contracts for Millennium One and Express, as SBC has pointed out. There was flip-flopping at the PUC about whether it's 258 or whether the contract says they can charge the higher amount.
Well, if you don't know what the agreement provides, why wouldn't it be appropriate for the PUC to look at it and decide and to tell you what it is?
Well, the PUC
why,
has...
And why is a jury more capable of making that determination than the PUC?
Well, two part answer to your question. First of all, the PUC has looked at it. And although it flip-flopped on the issue, it's come to the conclusion in Millennium One Express that the higher rate is permitted by SBC. And what they're saying is not that that's the rate that the PUC allowed. That just seems to be what is in the contract. Whether that's conscionable, whether it was deceptively arrived at or not, that is what is in there.
Higher,
so the PUC has spoken its piece on that issue.
Higher than 258, is that what you're trying to say?
That's correct. It's 1496 and up, depending upon which particular kind of electronic service order is involved. So the PUC has set its piece. But the fact that it's in the contract doesn't mean that there's not a DTPA case. It doesn't mean that there's not an antitrust case. It doesn't mean that this is a PURA case or an FTA case. Because what we're doing here is we're suing them based on the fact that they were building this and they're claiming.
You can't go to a jury, can you, making the claims that you're making without knowing what the reasonable rate was supposed to be?
Well, that's we do know what the reasonable rate was supposed to be.
I mean, in your interconnect agreement.
I beg your pardon?
In your interconnect agreement.
No. The reasonable rate was set by the PUC in the Mega Arb and in the Accutel case. Now, what has happened is that apparently that rate didn't make it into the contracts that my clients have. So the rate that is in the contract that my clients have is not one that was set by the PUC. It's one that was, quote unquote, negotiated by the parties, by SBC and various plaintiffs. Now, the reality is the contract language is identical, essentially, for all of them. But what is in our contract is not the same rate as the rate that was set by the PUC. So the PUC has already set in the MegaARP and in Accutel what the appropriate rate should be. In other words, if you ask us to make a rate for you, this is what the rate is. It's $258, no more. On the other hand, you can go over here and you can make a deal with SBC. And you can make a deal for pretty much whatever you want to. And if you guys come to an agreement between you, we'll rubber stamp it. And in this case, it looks to us as though we rubber stamped a deal in which you've agreed to pay $16 or $14.96 on up for something that we've already said should have been $258. But that's what's in the contract. So that's been the involvement of the PUC so far. And basically, at that point, they've said everything that there is to say for the PUC in a case like this, where what we're actually going for is not contract damages or the enforcement of a contract, but something different. We're going for deceptive trade practices, because basically what's happening here is we're being billed for manual labor that's not being done. We're going for unjust enrichment because we're paying for manual labor that we're not getting. We're going for antitrust because the effect of all of this is to artificially raise the price to us, to SBC's benefit, to drive us out of the market. Does that answer that particular question?
I'm still confused as to, I understand they're charging too much, Klein. But where I'm confused is, are they charging too much because they're charging you for manual when they're really doing it electronically? That's one overcharge claim.
Correct.
But the other is that they're charging the negotiated rate as opposed to the Accutel MegaARP rate. And how do those depend upon each other? Or do they?
Not really. The part of the problem is that in the context of the formation of these contracts, SBC says, we're going to be charging you, and this contract contains the rate that has been set by the PUC. If that were true, the rate would be the $258 that was set by the PUC in the MegaARP. When we actually start ordering electronically, what's happened is SBC says, well, it doesn't matter what's in the MegaARP. In this contract, you're being charged the manual rate because that's what you've agreed to. And frankly, you cannot read that contract and come to that conclusion very easily. It's just not plainly there, and it's counterintuitive. But that's something that's currently on appeal
as to what it actually says.
But we just don't want to go there because it's not necessary for us to go there.
So if a jury were to agree with you, then that would be contrary to a decision of the PUC in another matter.
Not at all.
Why would that not be contrary to Millennium One?
Because we're not asking the jury to tell us what the contract means. We're asking the jury to tell us, did SBC behave fraudulently? Was SBC deceptive in its trade practices? That's different.
If you're paying what you agreed to pay, how is there a deceptive trade practice?
Well, there's a dispute whether we agreed to pay that or not.
I understand, but you don't want to go there. So, if the answer to that is yes, that's what you're paying, then how is there deceptive trade practice? How is there fraud? How is there anything?
The fraud arises from the fact that SBC is saying that this higher dollar amount is something that you agreed to.
Right.
Which we didn't.
I understand that, but you don't want to go there. So let's assume that you did.
Well, assuming we went there, the question would be, I guess you're asking me, what does the contract say?
No, I'm saying, you say we don't have to consider what it says. We're entitled to go forward without knowing what it says. All right, but if you agree to it, we don't want to resolve that issue. But hypothetically, if you agree to it, then how do you have any case left?
If we had agreed to it, the question becomes: under what circumstances did we agree to it?
Okay, so maybe you have an antitrust claim, but it's hard to know how you have a deceptive trade claim.
Well, that arises from the fraud that is involved in representing that this contract has terms in it that it really doesn't. In other words, that this contract has the PUC ordered price for this event when it doesn't.
But if it does, I mean, it seems to me you're saying we don't have to decide that, but let's assume that it doesn't. Well, let's assume that it does.
Well, okay. If we were to assume that it does, then we would also have a breach of contract case because they would not have been charging us the lower price. Right? The question, as I understand you asked it to me, was let us assume that the contract had the lower price in it, the $258 for the electronic function. And if that were in the contract, then what we would have, in addition to whatever other claims we would also have a contract claim because we had been charged the higher price instead of the lower price, which is in the contract.
I understand, but you don't want to do that.
Right.
But I'm saying, what if you agreed to the higher price?
But we didn't.
I know that's your position.
If we had agreed to the higher price, unknowns to us, somehow, the question is, how did we get manipulated into agreeing to do that? Because if there is deceptive conduct involved, it's something more. It's something other than a breach of contract. So that's basically the driving or the answer behind Conquest Drilling Fluids, for example.
So that kind of gets me back to my original question. In order to get to the tort claims, you've got to resolve which price applies.
Well, we are assuming, and SBC is saying, that the higher price applies that's in the contract. Okay, fine, we're not going to argue with you about that. That may be in the contract, and that's also what the PUC has said in an Express and Millennium One, that in a contract almost identical to this one, the price is the $14.96. Okay? We're not going to contest that. What we're saying is that notwithstanding that, what you've got here is a situation where it was fraudulently induced, that it was fraud to say that the correct price was $14.96 when, in fact, the correct price that was set back in 1997 in the Mega ARB was $258.
But again, the presumption underlying that argument is that the Mega ARB price was the appropriate price for these contracts.
You're right. That is the assumption. But that is what the purpose of the Mega ARB was for. And that is also something that the PUC came back and reaffirmed in the Accutel case, which said, yes, we looked at this, and the appropriate charge in this instance for this item, which is a uni, it's called a uni, is $258. So the PUC has examined this not once but twice. So they've already exercised their special expertise. They've said, yes, for this electronic function, it should be $258. Two times they've said that already. So we don't need to defer to them to say the same thing again. Now, what they're saying is, that's not the question. The question is, what's in the contract? But again, we're not here on a breach of contract question. So you have to surgically excise that and understand that the causes of action that we have chosen to bring, which we are allowed to do, are only not breach of contract, but tort claims, antitrust claims, and DTPA claims. So under Smith versus Baldwin, the fact of the matter is that these kinds of claims aren't exclusive, mutually exclusive, DTPA or contract. You can eliminate one and choose to go with just the other. We're the masters of our pleading. We're the masters of the kinds of claims that we wish to pursue. The PUC has already exercised all of its expertise in this issue. There's nothing new for it to look at. It's looked at essentially the same contract language and made a determination on that. It's looked at the issue of what this item actually ought to cost, and two times now has said what it should be. Both times in a holding that was directly applied to SBC, because these issues are only for SBC. They're not for GTE or Verizon or some other ILEC. It's simply what SBC is allowed to charge for for this item. So PUC's expertise has already been drawn upon in order to get the number.
Why do they want to do it again?
Well, they want to do it again because they want to prevent this case from going to trial for as long as possible. I mean, we've already been through two removals and remands. We've been through two appeals to the 13th District, and now we're here before this court.
And they want to do that because?
Because the longer that they can string this out, the more likely it is that my clients are going to go bankrupt just because the whole field in which my clients operate are constricting, and more of them are going out of business. About 5 years ago, there were 300-some-odd companies like this, I believe, in Texas, and now we're down to about a third of that. Now, none of this is in the record, but that's a practical...
That has nothing to do with competition in the market. It's just they want to string you along and put you out of business. That's the only factor involved.
Right. For example, both Millennium One and Express, the companies that cases that they're relying upon, are out of business right now.
Won't you get this question resolved quicker by the PUC than you will go into a jury to verdict?
Not likely. I mean, the PUC took more than a year, maybe almost 2 years, for example, to do the Express case.
And trials in Cameron County take how long?
I beg your pardon?
And trials in Cameron County take how long?
To actually conduct a trial? This trial would probably take about a week in order to conduct. Now, it was basically ready, if you'll allow me to finish.
Sorry. Any further questions?
I have one question about my issue. What issue are you going to submit to the jury when you go to trial in this case? What are you going to ask the jury?
We're going to ask them, is SBC's pattern of conduct under these circumstances deceptive? Does SBC's pattern of conduct amount to antitrust?
And you're never going to ask them about what the contract says or make any assumption on what the proper rate is or what the language of the contract specifies the rate is. You're just not going to touch that at all when you ask the jury the questions.
Well, we're going to say that the PUC has said in Express that when Millennium won.
In another case involving another case.
But the contract language is identical. That's the key thing here.
Thank you. That's all.
Other questions? Thank you, Counsel.
Very briefly, Justice O'Neill, I think, has narrowed the case down to the crucial issue, and that is whether or not either the mega arb rate or the Acutel arbitration rate are required to be in the contract. The PUC is before this court in an amicus curiae brief that contains this statement. The Commission's 2002 Acutel arbitration, as well as the docket setting the initial default prices for interconnection agreements in the 1996 and 1997 mega arbitrations, has not resolved the questions regarding the price for electronic ordering under the CLEX interconnection agreements. So the PUC itself has taken the position that there is something left for them to do insofar as interpreting the interconnection agreements. Justice Yackel, in the Millennium One case, has written a very lucid discussion of why the Mega Arb and Acutel decisions do not affect an individual contract. He says you focus upon what's in that contract and look at the language in that contract to determine whether that the rates and as matched up to various services cover the dispute, whether cover the electronic processing that's at play. The argument that that this is basically a fraud and misconduct case does not improve the situation one bit for a number of reasons. But the fraud allegation at one level says that SBC failed to disclose that in the contract I'm handing you does not contain proper rates and that there are other rates that really apply. In other words, we fail to disclose that rates are required to be in the contract, which brings you back to the position of what is required to be in the contract. But there's even another level, because the PUC's approval of the contract, which is, and they have been deputized by the Federal Telecommunications Act to do so, and it is their exclusive jurisdiction to do so,
implies that the rates in the contract are non-discriminatory. And that can, and that is also a matter that can be brought before and should be brought before the PUC in a post-interconnection dispute.
Mr. Malice said that you waited too long to seek mandamus relief.
Well, Your Honor, there's several answers to that question. Actually, I don't think he says that we waited too long to seek mandamus relief. I think he says, really, that we waited too long to have a ruling on our plea in abatement or plea to the jurisdiction. Number one, there is respectable authority that exclusive jurisdiction light, as I call it, is not waivable. And that certainly makes sense because it's a matter, it's essentially a question of subject matter jurisdiction or the power of the court to proceed. Secondly, the latches timeline in this case simply does not bear fruit. We raised the issue of exclusive jurisdiction from the get-go, as we say, from our very first pleadings. And what he's complaining about is that the trial court didn't get around to ruling on it for a couple of years, which is true. But when the trial court got around to ruling in it and finally entered a written order that we could mandamus, we went through the Court of Appeals and up to this court in a matter of very short, probably about 4 to 6 months. And much of that time was taken up with the Corpus Christi Court of Appeals sitting and waiting legitimately to decide the issues in the case. It's a very, very bad rule that says that we should be penalized for delay and required to go through the entire process 5 years later, perhaps, to ultimately be told you got to start all over again. That's just very bad policy to apply a River Center type of latches to this case because it upsets the orderly process. I think your Honor see that what's really at stake in this case is an attempt to do an end run around the PUC, bring these cases in the court so we can get punitive damages. The system is set up precisely to prevent that.
Thank you, counsel. That concludes this cause and all causes for the morning, and the marshal will now adjourn the court.
All rise. Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas.